We welcome back to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Well, doing what we do here this afternoon. You got a lot of things going, including another book on the Beatles you're working on that'll be called Understanding All You See, Childhood, Genius, The Beatles, and Rock's Greatest Single.
Yeah, another Beatles book. I have to get the first two out. But as you know, things here happen in waves, and a lot is undertaken at once. So things are always in various stages of development and writing, and then they magically appear, and that's how I like to do it. But I sort of had the short list. I have an idea of a lot of the things that I'm going to write in the rest of my time on Earth, but I also allow for like surprises that are going to come up and things that I'm going to be doing that I hadn't maybe initially planned on. I mean, there's plenty of that happens every day, but like this was on my short list of music books that I knew I would be doing at some point, looking at this relationship between childhood and genius through the lens of the Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane single, because I think that the childhood and genius are intertwined in such a way that you can't separate them, which isn't to say that every child's a genius, but I think for someone who's truly a genius, they're thinking with a lack of blinders. They're thinking as a child would. They never sort of get that off switch. They never think in terms of can't. And so that single, Rock's best single, really epitomizes that to me.
And gave both Lennon and McCartney a chance to look back at their childhood, but also in some ways to a childhood that, like so many of us, that they have romanticized.
Well, I don't know that it's romanticized very much. What makes you say that?
Well, because I'm not sure. I mean, it comes across as sounding like a very dreamy, wonderful time, and I don't know that it was. Certainly not for Lennon, who, as we know, had a pretty rough childhood.
They both had a pretty rough childhood. I mean, McCartney lost his mother as well, and John Lennon kind of lost his mother twice in the set. And I almost wonder if the first way that he lost her, that she didn't want to raise her own kid. She sort of didn't want anything to do with him, and she lived like not that far off, was worse than the way he lost her in the death sense. But I find Strawberry Fields Forever to be a song of intense loneliness in a way, because it's someone trying to grapple with not just their identity, but an identity that has no overlap with anyone else, certainly within their particular purview. I don't know that a lot of things are tougher in life than that, especially before you've figured it out. So that idea of being crazy or being a genius, perceiving the world, experiencing the world and discussing the world and interacting with the world in a way that your peers don't and people older than you don't, that's a daunting thing. And it would have been a daunting thing to someone at that age, especially in that time, that country, and stiff upper lip and all of that, because emotions weren't given much vent. So I think it's a song of trying to work through that process for the song's narrator. That's why you have so much of the conversational element to the lyrics, and that halting quality where it's I think, I feel, oh no, I mean. There are all these sort of self-corrections. So no, I wouldn't say it's an idyllic, you know, rendering of some sort of bygone nostalgia-infused childhood at all.
You've written that you think the music on Revolver might be better than Sgt. Pepper. But Pepper is a better album. Can you explain?
These things are cyclical, and Sgt. Pepper has really taken a backslide over the last more than a decade now. There was a time when it was ubiquitously hailed as the best album rock and roll had ever produced. And so within like Beatles chatter, the consensus has been much more so for Revolver. Rubber Soul is kind of a dark horse. I think there's way too much emphasis on the end of the Beatles' career, so Abbey Road has also surged forward. And I think as we lose our ability to think critically, we've lost sight of what Sgt. Pepper is. And I don't mean this in some, like, Zeitgeist kind of summer of love way. Although really, there are two twin peaks of Beatlemania. There are two joint apogees. There's like February 1964, the hullabaloo with Ed Sullivan, and that's going to take us to A Hard Day's Night, the album, the song, the opening chord, and the film. And then there's what's going to transpire. Pepper comes out in late spring, 67, but it's really going to be like that summer. And it has these intangibles, almost like Jonathan Toews, the hockey player, but good. And that's more than the individual songs. If you look at like Revolver, sure, the songs, like if you go piece by piece, put it to you this way. We go around the diamond, right? And we do like the positional matchup. Who has the nod at shortstop? That type of thing. And so, okay, so Revolver has like six of the wins six of the nine positions if we're talking baseball. But Sgt. Pepper is the team that's winning 110 games. And it's just this alchemical intangible, this extra bit that it has where an artist is tapping into something beyond songsmithing, tapping into a kind of creative, empowering ether, a vibe, call it what you will. And I think we don't think about that with Sgt. Pepper because we just look at Eleanor Rigby and For No One and Taxman and George Harrison is stronger on Revolver. But I think there's a real need to get back to what's happening on Pepper.
There's also, you know, for any of us of my age or older who were around at the time, you can't get away from the cultural impact that existed at the time. I was pretty young, 9 years old or so when Sgt. Pepper came out, and I was not at that point. I was not a Beatle fan. It was a little bit too sophisticated for my liking at that point, but you couldn't get away from Sgt. Pepper. Everybody was talking about it. You heard it coming out of houses and cars, and that impact also changed the way I think people who were around then perceived the album.
It did, and you didn't have that certain like with Rubber Soul and with Revolver. They were albums that were approached as albums that bands make. And what I mean by that is for all of the overdubs and the automatic double tracking that you can't replicate Tomorrow Never Knows on stage, there were still backing tracks. And four guys were laying down those backing tracks together, and then they were augmenting. And Sgt. Pepper wasn't like that. It was, there's a great irony to Pepper. It's a highly clever irony if you think about it. So August 66, they're like, enough with the touring. Not long after, well, first they're going to do, separately, Lennon's going to do Strawberry Fields Forever, bring in his bandmates. McCartney, coincidentally, is going to write this song about Child himself, and Penny Lane, bring in his bandmates. They're going to start working on this album, this concept album, loose concept album, about a band that plays live. No one ever really talks about that. Like, that's, in a way, the same sort of societal middle finger that they give you at the end of With the Beatles with money. That's clever. That's what the Soviet futurists, Vajanov and Daniel Karms and people like that, would rave about is an inspired intertextuality. They're toying with their own mythos in the middle of still sort of writing that mythos script. That's heady. Not a lot of people would think in those terms. And I don't think they necessarily consciously thought in those terms. They just had a way of, that's how things came out. They came out in like the most clever way for them. So that's true. And they had an acetate copy of Sgt. Pepper, and they went to Mama Cass's flat in London, and they at dawn they were blaring it out into the London morning. And so I think that's sort of like a vibe that was picked up all over the world. But you know what? There's still something different because the same could be said, and it wasn't the same impact, but the same could be said about Hey Jude in 1968. That was another ubiquity. You just couldn't get away from Hey Jude. And we don't really have things like that, but we also don't have like musical art that rises to that level. But I think when we sort of strip that back and we just look at what is going on with Sgt. Pepper, we look at the way Paul McCartney isn't just playing bass, but he's adding his bass parts after everything else is done. He's let it all soak in musically. I mean, I totally get this. It's a lot like writing a story, and you have so much of it, and it's like done, and you're going through it. But you're seeing it differently because you've been around it for so long now, even if you haven't been around it temporally that long. And then all of a sudden you're saying, like I did today with the story, it's like, oh, knock all of this down and start with an entire new giant first paragraph that you weren't going to put there in the first place. So it was like kind of a Paul McCartney baseline added in, but like with fiction. So they were coming at it that way. And it was great for him. I feel like it was less great for the others. Wasn't that great for Ringo Starr sitting around learning to play chess? And Lennon wasn't contributing like he contributed before. You have a day in the life, but that's like half him. And it's sort of the Abbey Road approach to songwriting where we're getting fragments composited together.
I don't think they were aware, too, of what the reaction would be. And I remember a couple of years ago, Peter Asher telling us about maybe 2 or 3 days after the album was released, he and a couple of the Beatles went to see Hendrix, and Hendrix played the title cut, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because he had listened to the album nonstop and had learned it, and he didn't know the Beatles were going to be in the house, and it was this wonderful sort of cross-cultural moment.
Hendrix was ready to go with it, and if you parse through his live recordings from 1967, you go to like Scandinavia, you'll encounter versions of that song, that cover. And there were some, the Beatles weren't troubled by it, but partially because they were on drugs and nothing was really bothering them like that. But the Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane single, was seen as a flop of sorts because it only got to like 8 in the charts. And that's not what happened with the Beatles release, anything that they released. So it was sort of like this first, quote-unquote, commercial failure. I mean, a lot of bands, like the Yardbirds, you'd love to get to number 8 in the charts. And the Beatles certainly had songs that didn't measure up that were just going to automatically go to number 1. So there was maybe a small bit of doubt, but then they were doing something so different. And it was also... That's what you did as a rock and roll band. And that's how they first thought of themselves. You played, and now they weren't playing for people. And now they weren't even really playing for each other. They were making. They were assembling. They were creating sectionally. They weren't, although there were moments. You mentioned the title cut. The reprise of the title cut is one of the most, it's one of the shortest Beatles songs. It's one of the most exciting things in their entire canon. Now, in the version that opens the album, that's Paul McCartney playing lead guitar. He plays lead guitar. That's his solo on Good Morning, Good Morning. Harrison wouldn't have been able, he didn't have the technical proficiency to play that. But when they get to that reprise, that's straight out of the Star Club in Hamburg in 1962, which I would maintain might be their most exciting recordings, or certainly they're up there. It's live, and they did some overdubs or whatever, but Harrison's on lead guitar. They're in that sort of classic pre-fame lineup, and they're just burning and going for it. And that is going to segue into A Day in the Life is, I mean, you're going from one polarity to another there to close out that record.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Tapped Out. You write on the blog that you don't particularly like the writing of Mark Lewisohn, who wrote the multi-part, I think he's still working on more volumes of Tune In. Mark's been on the show, and I know I've got my thoughts about him as well. What is it that you don't like?
What I'm not keen on is that he's not a writer. Like, actually, because I'm rereading it, the unabridged version of Tune In. I wrote about Tune In. I wrote about it for like 3 or 4 places, and I mentioned the anecdote when I wrote about for Rolling Stone, and I got an email after, and the email was titled Bad Form. There's an editor yelling at me. Now, I wrote something, because I can do this, it's not hard for me. I wrote something completely different for everyone I wrote about it for. People are paying me so little money, I need the money. Like, what am I supposed to do? He said, Bad Form. I saw that you wrote about this for the Globe. But what this editor, hey, he's a good guy, he's not like a bad person, but before I'd given it like a certain, he had to have like a star rating too. And he insisted on giving him more stars. He said, because he worked so hard. I'm like, all right, I need the money. But that, to me, doesn't enter into it. So if you saw my marginalia, maybe a good thing that you don't, for this book, you would see someone just being vivisected on the writer's table. Because he can't write. He's a historian. And he's someone who goes around and he finds people who are teetering on the brink of death and asks them a question about how they interacted with John Lennon or how they knew this band that wasn't the Beatles and they called themselves this for a fortnight. And that kind of minutia is well and good in its place. But to me, that's not a reading experience. I want to be enmeshed. I want to be in not just the world of subjects, but I want to be in a world of ideas and insights that illuminate everything about the subject, but also take me beyond it. I want to be constantly surprised with the language. I don't want to know what's coming next. I don't want to have to correct your clunky attempt at a turn of phrase every single paragraph. So I think there's like a disconnect between what he is and what he sometimes tries to do. But if you take his book, Recording Sessions, that's more in his wheelhouse. It's going back some time. But anytime he tries to describe music, look, it's hard for people to find the language to describe music and what's happening. They either resort to jargon, and he doesn't know enough about music technically to do that, and you lose a lot of people anyway, or it's just kind of banalities and platitudes and lyric quoting, stock sort of empty adjectives. I need something incisive. I need to be able to just put my teeth deep into the apple, and I can't do that with his writing.
And I find it, and maybe because he's an historian, I find it very, very dry. And the Beatles, to me, are so much about emotion and passion, and there's just none of it there.
It's dry, and it's thorough, and these things have their place, because it's almost like a reference book. You can take something right down, but it's not for reading. Like, when I wrote my Sam Cooke book, I wanted to create its own work of art. I wanted to write the best nonfiction music book ever that could stand with any fiction I did. I wasn't going around, like, sometimes there'd be some old person who'd get really angry because I didn't, like, have some quote from, like, some great niece of Sam Cooke who didn't know him but saw a photo once, and just something like, they just want to see the quote. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're actually scanning for the quotes. And I think a lot of people with Lewisohn, they're scanning for the quotes. Now, there's something like it's looked upon now as kind of a trashy book, but The Love You Make. And it's just a single volume history about the Beatles. Like, a lot of it's seen through kind of like the lens of Brian Epstein, because that was the contact for this guy, Peter Brown, referenced in The Ballad of John and Yoko. But when I read that book, it was one of the first Beatles books I read, and I've reread it since, and I wrote about it for somebody, Rolling Stone, I don't know. There's a lot of Beatles stuff out there that I've done. I just felt like I was on acid in the bed reading that book, like I wasn't allowed to read it. It was like a prose contact high, and there's something about that book that captures their, it's not a drug thing, that captures their spirit, and that spirit is larger than them. That, to me, is more efficacious as a reading experience. I want a reading experience. I don't want just the dryness for the sake of thoroughness. I want you to just sort of put my soul on blast. I guess that's how I feel about anything I read. And maybe that's why I sometimes can look at it and be like, whoa, he has this. They're perfectly competent writers, some in nonfiction, that I'm just not keen on, that, okay, fine, they're professional, but they don't put my soul on blast. And if they're not doing that, I'm just going to go somewhere else and usually just make it myself.
You mentioned on the blog, too, let's hear your rationale behind this, that you think the Beatles' best song is one of their first, She Loves You. Why is that?
Oh, I do. I think it's radical. You have to think about this, because it's one of those songs that, like you were mentioning with Sgt. Pepper, just was everywhere. And it can sort of become taken for granted as this thing that was that was everywhere. And so She Loves You was that way. There is a lot happening in She Loves You. How these guys decided to write a song that is essentially, it's second person, but it's weird second person. It's like second person with elements of first and third person, but it's primarily sort of like second person. It's using that you. She loves you. I mean, think about just the title, She Loves You. That's a big statement. It's a big statement because of the implication that someone is relaying this knowledge that either, one, we don't know if you're that person, or we need reaffirmed to us. There's a whole story in that. Then you have, like, the way it opens with the chorus. It wasn't really done. I mean, there's some instances of it, but you go through that fill that Ringo Starr plays. And there is this, I mean, it's George Harrison's, like, shining moment on earth. The chords as they go into the verse. It's the most exciting transition. The way transitions are usually supposed to work in sort of like Brill building songsmithing, which is kind of what they did in a way, except they inverted it, is the big power move is from the verse to the chorus. They make their big power move at the beginning of their career from the chorus to the verse. I've never heard of anything like that. That's where, like, that's the thing that when Bob Dylan was going down the road in his car and he's hearing this playing and he pulls over and he's like, I had to get involved in, like, making the hits and, like, an electric guitar eventually. That's part of what that was. And you think of the selflessness of this song and further innuendo to say to someone, to a friend, you're going to blow this. And it's clear that the narrator is also into this girl himself. You don't get a lot of selflessness like that in life. You don't get it with young people in life, but you do get it with the core form of friendship. So already they're writing the sort of definitive song of friendship with these outrageous chord progressions, this inversion, this use of the second person. It's bluesy, and it's never, no matter how many times I've heard it, failed to surprise me. It's masterfully controlled. And you mentioned energy. Energy is proportionate to the quality of a work of art. Energy is big on radio. You talk about the people who are best that have ever been on the radio, Orson Welles. Energy is huge. Energy is huge in Citizen Kane. And energy doesn't mean like rawness and rah, 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 and out of control and the MC5 and all that stuff. It can be honed. And the Beatles had it honed and perfected in this perfect pop song.
And when you look around at the context of what else was being played on the radio when that first hit the top 10 in America, and I just called up the Billboard charts from that week, and it stood out because of what it was up against. And not that these aren't fine songs in their own right, but other hits in the top 10 were Leslie Gore's You Don't Own Me, The Ripcord's Hey Little Cobra, Surfin' Bird by the Trashmen, Rick Nelson's For You, and Bobby Vinton's There I've Said It Again. Now, if you've been listening to those songs on the radio and all of a sudden She Loves You comes on, it knocks you right out of your chair.
To be fair to Surfin' Bird, that would also knock you out of your chair.
That's true, yes.
Like, what the hell? Bobby Vinton, not as much. It's like, we sort of think of that as this desiccated era of pop and rock and everything. But if you were a savvy listener at the time, you would have had my guy Sam Cooke, you would have had the Shirelles, you would have had Dylan, you would have had Ray Charles, Bo Diddley was still doing stuff, you would have had like surf rock and all of that going on, and like with the Trashmen that you mentioned there, like the sort of proto-garage rock. There were things. There was dross as well. Arthur Alexander had his like big year in 1962, the year before this. But you could put that song on at any time, and it would sound like it was made tomorrow, like it hadn't been made yet, and you got an advance copy from the future. It's like, ooh, this showed up in the mail. It's not out yet. And I just remember listening to that song, and because like when I first got into them, the big songs that like you expected to really like go hard for, they were like, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Can't Buy Me Love, Hard Day's Night, like sort of those staples of the Red Album. And this was a huge hit. This was not a lesser hit. But it wasn't talked about as much. It was weird. And the thing is, it's great to be weird with your work when that work works. In other words, you're not being weird for the sake of weirdness, but because whatever that is specifically works. And any great work of art is that way. It's weird and it works. It's weird because it's not common, but it speaks to all of us. And I think anyone who listens to that song is pulled into that story, that dilemma of what do you tell your friends? What do you tell yourself if you don't tell your friend? How do you live with yourself and the production, the energy? There's never been anything like that song.
And you also say, and I think you make a great point here, you write, "I will tell you why the Beatles were what they were, melody."
Yes, and there are people out there. I feel like I'm the only person who really, my interest, what I'm invested in is always truth. And a lot of people like things for the sake of what it says about them or wanting to keep some connection with their own past. So if you say something that's true, no matter how well you back it up, there are people who are just hell-bent on saying that as a personal attack on them. So what I said in the blog was, if you transpose the Beatles' ability, and anyone who's heard this or read me about the Beatles, you're not going to think anyone knows more about them, thinks better about them. You're just not. That's going to be like an axiomatic truth. But if you transpose their ability and just say writing, they'd be like the example I gave was Charles Dickens. A lot of their appeal is simply the idea of that melody. You can hum along to it. You can sing along to Yellow Submarine in the shower. And they're great artists, but they're not like at the top of that particular Everest. They had this medium. And I'm not saying that you have to be in that medium to have maximum effect. Obviously, of all people, I'm not going to believe that. And I'm not running them down. But that is a big part of it. If they wrote novels or made films, they'd be something different. There's that sort of tribalism of that primitiveness of rock, where also a little cleverness is going to go a long way. It's going to stand out. And so that's why there's like such a big gap between the people who are best at that particular music, the style of music and all the styles within that style, compared to, I don't know, Jerry and the Pacemakers, not to put them down either, but there's like a big gap between like the all-stars and then like the pretty good players, I feel like, with rock and roll. So yeah, melody is, it's huge with the Beatles, and it can be that simplistic, because when we're listening to something and we're enjoying the melody and we're caught up in it, and the lyrics can be kind of vague, though not with She Loves You, that's one of the reasons it's so great, you start thinking it's about you and it's only about you, and it's just not like 3 minutes. It's really that simple. Now, I feel like you'd be like pelted with rocks in the town square for saying that, but it's the truth.
Nobody writes about the Beatles or talks about them like our friend Colin Fleming. Colin, thank you. Appreciate it. We'll check in with you again next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday on Downtown.